Today, our guest speaker expert is going to be Dr. Patty Vandekuvering, so we're real excited about that. Patty is called in as the host, so when she's talking, she'll be able to mute us all. But just in case, if you're not speaking, please mute your line. So *6 is mute, and then *6 again is unmute. So it's a toggle, which makes it kind of easy. But I'm going to quickly throw this over to Becky, who's going to introduce our speaker. And I also want to do special thanks to the Alumni Association Board, to our Outreach Committee, who came up with the idea for today's presentation. So good, a nice shout out to them. And just to let you guys know, if you have any other ideas for speaker topics, things that you're interested in, please let me know. And I can definitely hear somebody talking, so we definitely want to go ahead and *6 to mute your line. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and throw it over to Becky, and Becky can introduce us to Dr. Patty.
Okay, awesome. Again, thanks everyone for joining us and sending in your questions and participating. That's really, really fun to just hear everybody and feel that connection. I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Patty, and from hearing, it sounds like so many of you know her and appreciate her like I do. I first met her when I got my first guide dog, Pantera, in 97. And as you probably know, Dr. Patty's our Oregon Medical Director, and she joined Guide Dogs in 1996. And I know I've appreciated so much over the years her just extra care and warmth and concern and knowledge that she brings to DDB and helps, you know, to our guides. She's an Oregon native. We received her Doctorate of Veterinary Medicine from Oregon State University in 1987 after obtaining a Bachelor of Science degree in Animal Science. She has a special interest in working dogs, herd health, and canine athletes. In her spare time, she competes with her Brittany in field trials, confirmation, and agility. She enjoys gardening, horseback riding, and other outdoor activities. Thank you so much, Dr. Patty, for joining us, and we'll turn the time over to you.
Thanks, Becky. I just want to check, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I put you on my headset because it'll be easier for me not to lean forward and try and talk into the speaker. So, and then I'll go ahead and, as Teresa suggested, mute the line when I get going. And Teresa, if I really mess something up, I'm at my computer, so email me and tell me, wait.
You got it. You're going to be awesome.
All right, thanks. Yeah, when we were chatting about doing this, Teresa said, well, just think of it like a radio talk show. And I grew up watching and listening to Frasier on TV, right? So I asked Teresa, if I was Frasier, did that make her Roz? We got you guys covered today. All right, I'm going to go ahead and try and mute the line, and if there's any issue, Teresa, shoot me an email.
Okay, I'll let you know.
All right, so hopefully you guys can all hear me fine. So there were a number of questions that came in today with questions related to diets and dog food. So I'll share a couple of questions with you that came in and then share some thoughts I had about those. So one of them that came in said, you know, as I surf the net, I keep finding posts that slam kibble and extol raw, freeze-dried, and other more natural diets. Is kibble as bad as some would have us believe? And are the prey model diets that much better for my guide? And another nutrition-related question was about how much fiber and protein should be in a dog's food, and what about their stool? Should it be a small amount or a large amount? So when I thought about those two questions, it made me think a lot about how dog food really, for many people, is a very emotionally charged issue. You know, whether you talk to somebody at the pet store or whether you talk to a guide dog user or a pet owner, or even employees here at Guide Dogs, people have very strong opinions and emotionally based opinions about really what's good food. So I think that there's a lot of science behind some of the nutrition, the nutrient requirements dogs need, that sort of thing. There's a lot of science. And then there's a lot of hype and a lot of, I guess, trendy things that happen with the rest of nutrition. So whether we're talking about whether foods are raw or cooked or homemade or kibble or canned or all of that kind of stuff. One thing I think that's important for all of us to keep in mind, whether we're guide dog users or veterinarians like myself, is every dog's an individual. And so we can make some sweeping statements that are true for 85 or 90% of the dogs on the planet, but each dog's an individual, and so we have to always remember that about them. And they may need something a little different than the average dog or the typical dog, or they may respond in an atypical way. And so we all just need to keep that up, I guess. So when we think about the kinds of nutrients that are really important in dog food, there's a lot of question about things like protein and fat and energy, and that's part of the hype about the prey model diets, right? We give lots of protein and we give, you know, some vegetables, but no grain because dogs didn't eat grain in the wild. But the things that dogs eat ate grain, and dogs in the wild ate the whole animal, so they actually did eat grain. So that's just one of the, like, the little myths that gets tossed around out there. The protein and levels in a dog's diet, the typical dog, there's a, the nutritionists that have studied this say that the typical adult dog in normal activity levels needs about, well, a minimum of 18% protein in their diet. And max can go higher, but a minimum of 18%. And the typical high-quality dog foods that have been on the market usually have protein levels somewhere between 18 and 22 or 23% for the sort of normal adult dog. But some of the newer sort of diets that have been trendy have higher protein levels. Same with fat. Some of the diets have a lower fat and some have a higher fat. There's a nonprofit organization called AAFCO, A-A-F-C-O, which is an association of American feed control officials, and they actually have helped to evaluate and set some of the standards for levels of stuff in dog foods, and they're the ones who said, you know, minimum 18% to meet the requirements of the dog. And for fat, they say minimum of 5.5% fat. But again, looking at most of the sort of standard dog foods on the market that are high quality, they tend to have a little higher fat range than that. They may have 7 or 8% fat, but it varies. So they say minimum 5.5%. And then somebody also asked about how much fiber should be in the dog's food, and that's really variable. And the AAFCO, the AFCO people, have not set, as far as I could find, a minimum amount for fiber. When I look at the typical foods on the market, the good quality foods may have typically, say, 2 or 3% fiber, and they can go up as high as 10 or 15% in some of the lower calorie or high fiber foods that are meant to be therapeutic. So there's a very wide range in the amount of fiber that would be in a typical food. And when we look at the need for things like protein, again, because that's one of the things that's so variable in some of these new diets, dogs can only burn a certain amount of protein, and dogs that are highly active, like sled dogs, bird dogs, you know, working herding dogs, and even the wild dogs that they're mimicking these diets over, their activity level is much higher than our typical pet dog or our typical working guide dog who does a lot of walking and trotting but not a lot of full-out, you know, running hard. So I think our dogs don't necessarily require that really high level of protein that some of those highly athletic dogs do. When we feed our dogs excess protein, the body just has to break it down and get rid of it. So it breaks it down, and the nitrogen from the protein is excreted in the urine, so the kidneys have to work hard to make that happen. And then the leftover sort of matrix from the protein actually is turned into energy, which is then either used by the dog or stored as fat. So if we provide them excess protein, then the body has to work to break it down, and it can contribute to them being fat and add to the calorie content. So that's just, I think, a little something to keep in mind. When you're looking at all these different foods out there now that people are talking about, I think one of the things that you can do to help you know is this potentially a good quality food. And I say potentially because there's lots of nuances about the diets that can make them look good on the label, but maybe not be as ideal. So you can check the bags, and they should have a statement on there that says that the food has been determined to be complete and balanced per AFCO standards. And they can accomplish that in two ways. One way is that they can do some laboratory testing on the food that makes it meet the requirements set, and they can say that it's been laboratory tested to meet those requirements. The other option is that they can actually do feeding trials to demonstrate, really, this food does this super good nutrition stuff for the dogs. And we actually prefer food that's had those nutrition tests done, because then you can feel really confident that it didn't just look good on paper, but it actually performed well in the dogs. And that statement will be somewhere on the bag. So not exactly user-friendly for a lot of you, but that's where the employees at the pet store sure can come in handy, right? Because we can ask them to chase that information down for us on the label. When it comes to things like raw food, again, that's a pretty... it's a trendy thing right now, but I think it comes with some concerns that we need to be really aware of. Raw food can be contaminated with bacteria like Salmonella, Listeria, things that can make people sick or make your dog sick. And so I think that in particular we need to be extra cautious with raw diets when there's young children, when there's people that potentially immunocompromised in the family, that really puts them at high risk of potential for exposure to those bacteria, which could make them sick. So I'm not a huge fan of raw diets personally because of the risks associated with them, but there's a few companies who are working on ways that they can potentially, like, pasteurize that food so that the bacteria would be killed and the food would still be quote-unquote raw and be able to be used. So I think in the future there might be some safer ways to use raw food. People do make home-cooked versions of food and see, I think, a lot of benefits from that too. If you like the same kinds of benefits you would get from raw. So, but I think in general we have such great kibble options on the market now and such variety that we should be able to find something that's easy and kibbled that works for the majority of the dogs. So I think those were kind of the notes I had about that first question, a couple of questions, and there's one more food-related question. Which I'll chat about just a little bit, and then a question about supplements, and then I might take a quick break and see if I said anything that confused people. So a couple of other the topics that came up, one of you asked about treat rewards. Are there things that would be permissible and motivate a sometimes bored guide? Do we have suggestions for healthy treats? And I will tell you that I talked with the class supervisors about this question, too, to get their input on what they've seen be really effective. And one of the key points that they made, which I wanted to make sure we shared with you, was that they said, you know, to them the key word in that question was motivation. What's going to motivate our guides? What's going to help them to be motivated? What are they going to find meaningful or rewarding? And they said, the super said, you know, sometimes a good game of tug or a thank you halt with a quick break off is a very meaningful reward to a dog. And so even in our excitement about treats, not to lose track of those motivations as well. And some types of food rewards that are healthy and could be used in addition to the normal kibble that you feed is you might just be able to use a different type or a different flavor of kibble, right? That would be novel to them, and they might find that more rewarding. Here in training, when the instructors are working the dogs, we use a product called Tillman Treats, T-I-L-L-M-A-N, and those are made by Natural Balance, and the dogs find them very tasty. Charlie Bears are another option that sometimes are used. One of the soups said, you know, he finds like a good quality dog biscuit and breaks those up and sometimes uses those if they need something different for the dog. Or small pieces of apple or carrot that could be put in the pouch would be also an option. And they said sometimes they even will, if they need a real high value treat, cut something like string cheese. But note, that's not really safe to like leave exposed to the elements and not the refrigerator for an extended period of time. So that would be sort of a short duration treat thing. And I think, you know, again, because all the dogs are individuals, we need to keep in mind that for some dogs, these little changes in what they eat could cause a little stool trouble or a little stomach trouble. So we'll want to be cautious about that. And also just remember that all of that is extra calories. And so we need to just be real conscious about the dog's weight, make sure we're not accidentally increasing their calorie intake by too much. And sort of the last food-ish related question is a question about supplements. And it said, you know, are there any specific joint supplements or daily vitamins that we would recommend? There are tons of articles and resources that encourage these products, but it's challenging to know what might be helpful and what is too much. I know many grads may shy away from these products due to cost, but are there some alumni who, use all kinds of natural products, etc. So, thinking about that, I think, you know, in general, for typical
there are four zero participants
dog food,
currently in the meeting.
Supplements I don't think are necessary for the most part. Again, each dog's an individual, so there may be a few circumstances people can come up with where they've seen a difference. But I think in general, not necessary to supplement our really high quality foods. That being said, though, I think that there are times where supplements can be useful. An example might be, we'll talk a little later about, but dogs with skin trouble sometimes benefit from fatty acid supplementation. Or another example might be that dogs that have joint difficulties or stiffness or soreness sometimes benefit from some of the joint supplements on the market. And the challenge with all of these things is that a lot of the information about them or the evidence about them working is anecdotal. It's case studies where somebody said, hey, my dog did much better on this, or my other dog did much better on that. And it becomes difficult when those things aren't sort of scientifically organized, right? They're not controlled, so some dogs are on supplement and some aren't, and you can actually measure the improvement. So I believe there is some benefit sometimes. And the challenge that we all have as veterinarians, and I think you guys as consumers of these products, is being able to understand which supplement and which dog is really going to benefit. And then, until we get good science behind answering that question, there's going to be some guesswork involved in, well, should I try this one or should I try that one? Other challenge with supplements is that they're not regulated like drugs and medications are regulated. And so there are many more variables in what goes into the products and into how they're manufactured and a lot of variation in the quality that isn't so prevalent when we're talking about actual drugs and medications, because those have to go through like FDA-regulated processing and testing. So it's harder with supplements, but there certainly are good ones out there. And there is some voluntary quality control that some of the companies do. So specifically this question asked, are there things that we use or recommend? And I will tell you that one that we use here on campus and is also used at the San Rafael campus in some cases is a supplement called Dasuquin, D-A-S-U-Q-I-N. And that's got glucosamine and chondroitin, and it's also got an avocado extract in it. And it's anti-inflammatory and helpful for dogs with, we use it for cases of dogs when we've done joint surgery and things like that on them to help help their joints feel better. So it's a hot topic, and I think one that over the years we're going to continue to learn more about and find better applications, and I don't mean better ways to use the stuff, but we're going to be able to choose better which product for which dog, because they really are trying to work on some science behind some of this. So I'm kind of encouraged about that. So I'll just unmute for a second and see if anything I said confused anybody. We've got a number more questions, so I don't think we have a lot of time to just talk and do open-ended questions right now. But if there's any clarifications that you guys would like me to make, I'm going to unmute right now. Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah. Can you hear us?
Okay, I can't hear you. Let me try again.
Hello?
Oh,
there we are.
So now it says you're unmuted.
Yeah.
Okay. Did I confuse anybody with anything? Do I need to clarify any of that?
I have one question. Joel Foster here. I add a little bit of rice. I find it helps and gives better stools. Questions?
If it works for you, that's fine. I don't think that, I've never seen anything specific that says that would work for all dogs, but if it seems to be working well for your dog, then I think that's fine. Me too. Okay. Well, let me go ahead and remute, and then the next little section with some questions related to dental care. So, move on to that.
Thanks, Patty.
Okay, so related to dental care, one of the questions that came in says, my guide broke a molar while chewing on a Nylabone. And I was told by the vet clinic at GDB where she had her broken tooth extracted to throw away her Nylabone and to only give her rubber bones. Nothing that would hurt if I was to bang it on my knee, and Hurley bones were recommended. So can you please comment on the general safety of Nylabones for our guide dogs and other ways we can care for our dog's teeth? And then the second dental question was related to what do we recommend for dental hygiene? There are treats like Greenies, there's dental wipes, there's finger brushes, toothpaste, and now even a doggy spin power brush. So what's considered best practice for our guides? Circling back to the first question about Nylabones, really difficult balancing act, I think, there. It is true that chewing on anything hard, whether it's a Nylabone, an ice cube, deer antlers, all of those kinds of things can actually cause tooth fractures in our dogs because, you know, they wedge them back in their teeth and they put so much torque on them. So there certainly is a risk there that anything hard we give them could cause tooth fractures. But chewing also provides some benefits to our dogs, and I think the tricky thing is finding the balance between the risks and benefits. You know, for some of our guides that are a year and a half old or 2 years old and they're young and enthusiastic and spending a lot of time hanging out waiting for us to be ready to go to our next adventure, some of those guys need an outlet for themselves while they're hanging out. And if we don't give them something appropriate to chew on, they're going to find something inappropriate to chew on, whether it's your desk or furniture or socks or any of those numerous other less appropriate things. And the consequences from that sort of chewing, I think, can be much more serious than a broken tooth is. So I would love to prevent broken teeth, but I also think that we have to keep the whole picture in mind for the dog. And the best thing to do is just choose the safest, most effective thing that works for that individual dog. So if your dog is one who happily and safely satisfies his chewing needs by chewing on something like a Kong or a Hurley bone, which is another rubber sort of bone, or the Go-Nut sticks, I think those are great options. And if that satisfies your dog's needs, that's terrific. If your dog destroys those, which some dogs do, or doesn't find them entertaining at all, which is also a real thing, like my own personal dog, they turn their noses up at them. Then I think, you know, you have to, if you're going to use something like an Isle Bone, then we just know that there's a small risk associated with that that we have to choose to accept, I guess, right? Because the benefit the dog's going to get seems to make it worth the risk. So choose the softest toy, so to speak, that is safe for your dog. So if your dog will chew the rubber toys and enjoy them and not destroy them, I think that's safer. But if that's not enough for your dog, then I think moving to something like the Nyla Bones and that type of toy is A-okay as well. Dental hygiene, so just basic stuff. What's considered best practice? Honestly, best practice is brushing daily well with a toothbrush and with toothpaste that's made for dogs. I think that every other day is probably very reasonable for most dogs as well. So a lot of people sort of aim for every day and accept it when they hit every other day, and that's okay. So as far as whether you use a toothbrush or a finger brush or even the new Power Doggy Spin Brush, which I didn't know existed, so you guys just taught me something. You know, I think whatever is most effective for you and for your dog is the thing that's going to be most important. I think the dogs have a varying acceptance rate to being brushed, having their teeth brushed. And so for some dogs, turning on a Power Spin Brush and trying to put that by their face, they're not going to appreciate it. It's going to take a long time to get them to accept that well, where they might handle a regular toothbrush or a finger brush just fine. I know for other dogs, their enthusiasm for playing with the toothbrush and having their teeth brushed and eating the toothpaste is actually more the challenge that you guys run into. And again, I think then, you know, that goes back to spending some time working on actually training your dog to sit quietly and let you do what you need to do. And that's just one little step at a time, right? Gradually getting closer and closer to the ideal situation of sitting still and letting me brush the teeth. I really encourage people, because all of us have, I think, a limited amount of time to do those sorts of things, that if your time's limited, to be able to focus it mostly on the outer surfaces of the teeth, the outer surfaces of the molars and the canines, because that's the place where, on most dogs, we see the most buildup of tartar and debris. So if you're like me and have kind of limited time, then that's the area that I would really spend my energy focusing on, is the outer portion of the dog's teeth. So I'm going to quickly unmute for clarifications again. So let me do that here.
Okay. Hello? Can you hear me?
You're unmuted. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yep.
So can you talk about greenies a little bit?
You know, greenies are probably okay to give dogs. You know, they get tested but I don't think that they're as effective as brushing teeth on a regular basis. And I personally find them, for my own dogs, a little expensive, so I don't usually give them, because my dogs will eat them in one sitting, and that's like $3 or $4 a pop. So I haven't messed with them a lot, and I don't know that if they would provide enough benefit used just every once in a while to make it worth the investment.
Okay, and besides maybe considering the calories, is there any dietary concern?
For most dogs, no.
Okay.
Does using the using the Science Diet dental formula kibble as a treat, like maybe three or four a day. Does that help at all?
I think it does, yeah. So the dental formula, I don't know if they've changed the name, or there's also a prescription diet one called TD. And that's the one I had studied the most about several years ago. And that one really does because of the way they've built it. The kibbles are big. They're blocks. And the dogs have to bite through the kibble to be able to chew it. It's too big to just swallow. And the way that they built the, lined up the fibers in the kibble, the dog's teeth actually have to meet in the middle of the kibble to make it break apart, so the fibers rub all the way up the teeth. So I think that does make a difference. A lot of the kibbley type treats that they tell you will help your dog's dental condition, when the dog bites the treat, it shatters. So just the tip of the tooth is cleaned by the chewing action on the kibble. Not so much of the they may help a little bit, but I think that the patient is the most helpful.
Maybe,
what about bad breath?
So bad breath, a whole other topic, and which if we have time at the end, I'm happy to chat about, but I think I'll
want
to see if vaccines and skin and some other things that people ask about first. So, but if we have time at the end, we'll get to that one for you. All right?
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and remute, and then we'll move on.
Good question.
Okay. So, one of the questions that came in is, which vaccinations should our guide dogs get and which ones are optional? So I just wanted to kind of quickly run through that for you. Guide Dogs recommends that these dogs have a... Well, actually, let me back up one step. Our guidelines are based on some guidelines that were studied and then established through the American Animal Hospital Association. And they pulled together a variety of experts in a number of fields related to veterinary medicine and to viruses and to immunology and shelter medicine. And so they put this whole group of experts together to really pour through all of the information that was out there and the science and the hype and try to come up with, well, what really makes sense. And they reconvene this group on a regular basis and update those guidelines. And so Guide Dogs is operating. Our guidelines are very taken mostly from there. So they have a group of vaccines that they say are core vaccines that they believe and they recommend that every dog should have. And that includes the distemper parvo vaccine, which some people call DA2PP or some people call it DHPP. And also rabies vaccine. So so Guide Dogs recommends that the distemper parvo or DA2PP vaccine be given every 3 years. They get an initial series as a puppy, they get a booster when they're here in training, and then every 3 years out there with you guys. And rabies vaccine also every 3 years, unless you happen to live in a location where they've got some local ordinance that says you need to do it more frequently. And that's uncommon right now, but it does happen occasionally. Other vaccines that are out there that you might consider, I think, depending upon the lifestyle of your dog, so you might consider these quote-unquote optional vaccines. Kennel cough or Bordetella vaccine is a vaccine that is optional based on risk. So if your dog is going to have exposure frequently to other dogs, then that's something you may want to get on an annual basis. Or if you don't normally do that, but let's say you decide to come to an alumni reunion or to one of the conventions, or maybe your dog's going to need to board somewhere with a bunch of other dogs around, then if you don't normally do the Bordetella vaccine, that's a good one to get maybe a month before you go, and then your dog will be protected against Bordetella and parainfluenza. A lot of people say that's quote-unquote kennel cough, but there's there's a whole bunch of different bugs that can cause kennel cough. The two main ones are the Bordetella and the parainfluenza, but there are more things. So that's a vaccine that's optional based on lifestyle. Leptospirosis vaccine is a vaccine that's optional based on lifestyle as well, although I think that disease prevalence is becoming more prevalent in various areas, and sort of the range of this problem is spreading. So more areas of the country are recommending vaccine now than they used to. And it's a vaccine for bacterial disease that these bacteria are shed in the urine of wild animals usually, and rodents, and obviously dogs, if they were infected, could shed that in their urine as well. And that's a vaccine that needs to be given once a year. Sort of in general, the bacterial vaccines, like kennel cough and like lepto, we don't get as good a response to the vaccines, and so they have to be given once a year instead of every 2 years. And then in some parts of the country, Lyme disease vaccine is important. Certain parts of the East Coast and the upper sort of Midwest areas where Lyme disease is common, then vaccination may be a good tool to help your dog prevent infection. More important, I think, is that we all provide good tick control, because Lyme disease is spread by ticks, and so if we can prevent ticks from attaching to our dogs, then we're going to be able to prevent Lyme disease and minimize the need for vaccine, except in really high-risk areas. You know, there used to be a vaccination on the market for Giardia, but it's off the market now. So that one you don't need to worry about. And then there's also a vaccine out there that's used frequently for coronavirus. But the experts that looked at that said, you know, that's really the primary place that virus causes disease might be in young puppies. In adult dogs, they didn't see... the experts didn't see a lot of need for using that vaccine on a regular basis. So that's kind of the gist of the vaccine stuff. Looking at the time, we have about 20 minutes left, so I'm just going to kind of zoom forward into the next set of questions, which relate to skin conditions and allergies. So I have a couple of general comments I'd like to make about skin and allergies and itchiness. And then I'll move into the specific questions and just kind of give a little update based on those. So skin problems, itchy problems, scabs, sores, all of that kind of stuff, you know, sorting that out can be really complicated. Sometimes there's a primary infection that causes it, a bad kind of bacteria or something that may set the dog up for trouble. But I think a lot of times... the skin problems that we see in our dogs are secondary. And they may be secondary to trauma, like the dog scratching, and then that makes minor abrasions on the skin, which then can become infected and irritated and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes that trauma can come from grooming. Some of the wire bristled brushes are a little sharp on the ends. The slicker brushes can be that way, and even some of the regular wire ones, as they get older, can be a little rough. And if we're, you know, grooming our dogs really, really well and getting that brush down on the skin, sometimes we actually cause trauma to the skin, just micro scratches, micro abrasions, and then the dogs can get irritation and infection associated with that. If you're thinking maybe that's happening with your dog, certainly then just changing like to a Zoom groom kind of tool would be maybe a good choice. Sometimes these irritations and infections can be secondary to being infested with fleas or with mites, things like that. Sometimes they can be nutritional related. If we're maybe not feeding the best food in the world, maybe it's not the best balance. Maybe we thought it was good food, but it's really not a balanced diet. We can see sometimes there's a nutritional component to that. And then, you know, certainly in some cases there's an allergic component to having skin. And that can be contact allergies, something that's irritating to the dog on contact. It may be sometimes allergy-related, or it could be due to allergies in the environment of any sort. So It could be pollens or grasses or dust or dust mites or any of those kinds of things. So when I start to sort of break down skin problems in general, and how excited do I need to be about them, do I need to jump in and test for allergies, all those kinds of questions that start to circle, I usually say, well, is this a single episode? Is this happening now? Or maybe it's happened a few times, but it's very infrequent. And if that's the case, I usually approach them, I think it's reasonable just to treat the episode as it comes up. And what treatment you do depends a lot on what you're seeing. But if the issues are persistent, they're pretty constant, or they're frequently recurring, then I think, you know, trying to sort out is there an underlying cause for that problem is important. One thing that many dogs with skin disease, whether it's scabs and crusts or whether they're just itchy in general, whether they have underlying allergies, I mean, any of those things, one tool that I think is often overlooked is the benefit of using medicated baths as a treatment. You know, when we're doing medicated bathing, we're able to remove whatever's irritating from the dog's skin. We're actually able to medicate the skin, too, which is great. And the type of shampoo I might choose varies a lot with what I see going on with the dog. You know, whether it's just itchy and the skin looks okay, or whether that they have pustules or sores or discharge or all those kinds of things. So I think, you know, getting some veterinary input on what type of medicated shampoo you use is probably pretty important. But the technique of how you bathe the dog is also important. So I just want to run through that briefly because I think it's a tool that you guys, it's a pain to give your dog a bath sometimes, but I've seen it be effective so many times that I really want to encourage you about that. So, you know, the key thing about bathing your dog is to use kind of lukewarm water. We all like to have a nice hot bath, but that can actually make the dog's skin a little itchier. So use sort of just lukewarm. Wet the dog down. You want to work the shampoo in all the way down to the skin, and then you want to leave the dog soak with the shampoo on for about 10 minutes, which feels like an eternity, so you really got to set a timer somewhere because 2 minutes is going to feel like it's been long enough and you're not even there. So make sure you give it a good 10 minutes to soak, and then rinse the shampoo really well. A lot of the manufacturers that make these kinds of shampoos often also make a cream rinse or a conditioner, kind of a leave-in product that you might be able to apply after the bath and then just rinse lightly. And that might be something to consider as well. When I'm using these kinds of therapies for dogs, we often think about bathing them once a week while they're bad. I have a Labrador that lives at my house who has itchy skin seasonally. And during his bad seasons, we're able to bathe him once a week, usually for 2 or 3 weeks in a row, and then we can decrease the frequency to, as soon as he starts telling us he's itchy, we bathe him again. And that avoids him sort of being miserable, uncomfortable, and it also saves him from breaking out in sores. So it's a really good tool. I just wanted to make sure you guys all knew about and encourage you to ask your vets about. On to the specific questions. There was a question. It said, my 3-year-old lab has had 3 episodes of scabbing in 3 different areas on her skin, which the vet cannot explain. Perhaps it's an allergy? The first outbreak under neck near her collar, and she scratched it to infection. The second outbreak was on top of her neck above her collar. We caught that earlier and treated it with wipes. The third outbreak was inside the flaps of her ears. That's ruled out fleas and injury and couldn't really explain. Do we have any suggestions? It's certainly possible that allergies are an underlying cause, but when you start talking about right around the collar, once in a while, moisture gets trapped under there, anything that causes increased moisture or increased heat on the skin can allow overgrowth of some of the bacteria or some of the yeast that normally live on the skin, and then they can set up the dog to have an infection and be irritated. So the reason allergies can predispose to these sorts of skin infection-related things is because allergies cause the skin to be a little inflamed, which makes it both more moist and more warm than normal. So anything that increases moisture or increases warmth potentially could contribute to developing skin. some lesions. And a dog like this, I think, you know, medicated shampoos might be a good choice for on the areas that that the dog is sore. Another question then said, well, when your dog has an allergy, other than giving Benadryl, is there anything more a person can do to help the dog stop his constant scratching? And that's a tough question to answer because allergy is such a broad term. You know, if it's food allergy related, certainly we can look at trying different alternate protein and alternate carb source diets to see if the dog would do better on those. If it's something in the environment, then maybe we can remove the offending thing, although I think that usually is pretty frustrating. Some dogs that are allergic to dust and dust mites do better if we get, like, neurotically clean and sweep and vacuum a lot and get as much of that out of the environment as we can. Some dogs are allergic to cedar, and a lot of dog beds we buy over the counter there at the pet store have cedar in them, a little cedar shaving. So sometimes it's as simple as removing the bed. But often I think the cases are more complicated than that. Dogs like that, bathing may be a useful tool, in addition to the other tools that you might use. And the last question about this sort of thing was, you know, my dog scratches underneath her mouth and on her chin. The vet says she has allergies, and I've bought the allergy medicine, but it doesn't seem to help. Do you have any suggestions? And my only thought about that was that, you know, sometimes contact irritation contributes. So some dogs' plastic food bowls irritate their chin, so it might be you want to switch to a metal one if you're using a plastic one. And also, I think since anything on her chin could contribute to the irritation, it might be that we want to use a little Medicaid shampoo and clean her chin regularly, because those things might help. And then if there's any secondary infection, like if she's got a little yeast infection in there, a little bacterial infection, the allergy medicine won't fix that. It might help with the inflammation, but it won't necessarily fix the infection. So there may be a need to address that as well. So that was sort of the allergy-related topics. And then I think since we've just got about 10 minutes left, I'm going to zoom right into the last set of questions, which were some behavior-related questions. So one of them that came in said, you know, labs are pretty easygoing and can be very quiet most of the time. How do I know if my guide's a little low or depressed, and how might I manage this? And I guess I would suggest that you look for overall clues beyond just the activity level to help you determine if your dog is feeling low or feeling ill, and that's why he's too quiet, right? So you'd want to be able to take into account not just activity level, but the dog's level of engagement with you, because you know how it normally engages with you. And if it's separating itself from you for some reason or choosing not to engage, then that's another bigger clue to look at. Or all the typical things that we would think about from a health standpoint, eating, drinking, urinating, defecating, are those things normal or not? You know, if you think your dog is down or depressed, is there a reason that would be? I mean, did you lose another dog in a household that was their best buddy, or were the kids their best buddy and the kids just left for college and now their whole world seems sort of upside down? So if there's a predictable reason for them to be off, then I think sometimes giving them a little time is okay, right? They're like us. They have to process things. And giving them something else that's really positive and enjoyable for them to do, maybe changing up their routine just a little bit, in the places where it's going to have holes because they're missing the other person or whatever. I think some of that stuff can make a difference for the dogs. Another question that came in said, there are times when I'm unable to take my guide outside until later in the day. Does this make a difference in their emotional well-being? I want to keep my guide happy, but sometimes I can get very busy and going outside can be delayed except for relieving times. So if I read this question correctly, this person saying, I'm committed to getting my dog out to relieve on time, but sometimes the rest of my life doesn't go as smooth and I don't get my dog out to do the things we normally do at the same time we normally do them. And, you know, I think most dogs are creatures of habit to some degree, some more than others for sure. And they quickly develop a comfort level with their normal routine. And I think a lot of dogs, because people have themselves a very set routine, so everything happens at the same time every day, those dogs tend to notice a lot more if they miss their normal morning play session or their normal morning romp, or if it's an hour late or something. Other people who have lives maybe a little more like mine, my schedule varies all the time with my dog, so they never know for sure what time playtime is going to be, which isn't great for having predictable relieving schedules like you guys need, by the way. So not that I'm advocating insanity, but my dogs are kind of used to that, and it doesn't cause them stress because it's just the life they know. But your dogs may have a different deal. So I don't have a serious concern about your dog's emotional well-being if occasionally, you know, your schedule changes, even if it's normally routine. But I think every dog's an individual. And if your dog says it causes him a great problem, you know, then spending the energy to try and change that as infrequently as possible is a good thing. But we're fortunate these guys are pretty plastic most of the time, and they'll bend a little bit for us. And then there was another question about playing games and playtime at home. What if Find the Toy gets boring? Do you have other ideas? And I actually am going to ask another expert for some information for you guys on that one. And Teresa, I'm going to unmute the phone so you can chat, but I think you've got some great input for them that goes beyond what I could come up with. So I'm going to unmute and let you share some info about that one.
Hey, everybody. yeah, if you guys want to go, if you, I don't have the power to mute everyone, so if you're able to star six, that's great. I think one of the things that, you know, spending time with Michelle Pouliot and those folks, that it seems like any of the stuff that we've learned in class with Clicker, so teaching your dogs different things to do, they like to keep their brains, you know, sharp, and they like to be engaged with you. So for those of you that kind of know the Clicker game, so things like, trying to teach your dog to target different places in your house or those kind of things, that can really keep your dog engaged and really build the relationship between you and your dog. So I would strongly encourage that. My dogs both love to play hide and seek as well. I'll have them sit and stay in the kitchen, and then I'll go and hide one of their toys and try to go get, you know, try to, you know, have them try to go find it, which is actually really good because it gets them using their nose and that kind of thing, which is something that we kind of don't want them doing when they're guiding, and so kind of keeps that part of their brain stimulated as well. So I think hide and seek is a great great playtime thing. And it's kind of a crack up because it's kind of interesting to see how long it can take them to find stuff, but it's fun. So those are some of the things that I do. I think, you know, obviously, like the tugging those kind of things can be good as well. So I think mostly dogs just really want to spend time with you and, you know, petting and cuddling and playing around is great. Also, if you have friends or family members who have dogs that you know are safe for your dog to play with, you know, in a fenced and safe area, that can be really, really good for them because, you know, when they're walking around with us, they're walking in a harness usually, and, you know, they're walking, not sort of running and jumping and rolling and playing, and that kind of activity can be really good for them just to kind of just let all that go, get them to use those muscles that maybe they need to be using and sort of stretch out some other ones. So so I guess those would be my suggestions.
Somebody had a suggestion there.
I know. Yeah, I made the mistake of teaching my second guide dog how to speak. So that's maybe not the best
something
one.
That I just something that I just did. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
This is Holly with Tyra. My dad just had a knee replacement last week.
Uh-huh.
And so he was in the hospital for 4 days, and so we went every day to see him. And Tyra is a year. We've been together almost 2 years, 2 years in February. And so she's pretty young still. And I got off the elevator, and I knew my dad's room number. And so I said, okay, can you find Grandpa? And so she stopped. And, I mean, you know, we're in a hospital. You know, the ORs are on that floor. You know, the whole thing. So she stops, and that nose went up, and she sniffed the air. And his door happened to be closed. But so we went past, we overshot it by one room. But, you know, she was that close. And that was just a neat thing, you know, for her to find as a challenge, mm-hmm. even though she was working.
Yep.
You know, she still, you know, that was really, really neat.
Yep, yep.
To watch her do.
Awesome. Very good. Well, let's see what time we have here. Oh, gosh, it's already 5 o'clock. Well, I want to thank Dr. Patty for joining us today and giving her expertise to us. We really appreciate your joining us and letting us, you know, learn from all of your experience. So thank you so much for setting aside some time for us today, Dr. Patty.
Yes. Super happy to help. Thanks for inviting me.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, I'm going to go ahead and sign off here. I want to thank all of you for joining, and I have recorded this, and it'll be up on the website in a couple of days, hopefully. So y'all have a good week. All right, take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye.